Welcome back to Behind the Scams. Today's deep dive is the Nigerian astronaut, anatomy of a cosmic swindle. Although scams are a serious matter, it is also important to take a look at just how foolish some scams are and how foolish some scammers can be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of these setups are just so wild, you honestly can't believe anyone would ever fall for them.
Right. And before we get into the really wild stuff, just a quick reminder that Behind the Scams is part of the SOS Media Network. We are here as advocates. You know, we just really care about helping you avoid this kind of stuff.
Exactly. We aren't law enforcement or anything like that. We just spend way too much time researching these frauds so you don't have to.
Yeah, we read the fine print so you stay safe. So today we are unpacking what we call the global taxonomy of deception. We're looking how the anatomy of a con has evolved over time. And to set the stage for you, I have to share this piece of internet lore I dug up.
Oh, I know exactly what you're about to bring up. The space plea.
Yes. It is just a masterpiece of bizarre fiction. So imagine you open your inbox and you get an urgent, highly confidential email from a man named Dr. Bakir Tunde.
Right, who is supposedly some high-ranking official.
Yeah, he claims to be the astronautics project manager at Nigeria's National Space Agency. And Dr. Tunde is emailing you, a completely random person, because he has this massive geopolitical nightmare. He says his cousin, Air Force Major Abacha Tunde, is secretly stranded in space.
Which is just, I mean, the sheer audacity of that premise is hilarious. Stranded in the vacuum of space, relying on a random Yahoo email address for salvation.
Exactly. And the backstory is incredibly intricate. The scammer claims Major Tunde was the first African in space, sent on a highly classified mission to the Soviet Salyut 6 space station in 1979.
Salyut 6 was real, by the way.
Right, they sprinkle in real words. And then he supposedly goes on a second secret mission to Salyut 8T in 1989. But here's the catastrophic twist. While he's up there, the Soviet Union collapses in 1990.
Uh-huh. A little historical drama.
Yeah. So his fellow Russian crew members take the Soyuz return craft back to Earth, and the major seat is just, well, taken up by return cargo, so they just leave him behind in orbit.
Abandoned to the cosmos because of some bureaucratic oversight during the Cold War, it reads like a bad sci-fi novel.
It really does. And the email claims he has been up there for decades, surviving on occasional unmanned progress supply drops. But my favorite line in the whole thing is where the doctor assures you that the major is in, quote, good humor, but ultimately wants to come home.
Well, you know, maintaining a positive attitude after floating alone in a metal tube for 30 years is pretty impressive.
So the pitch is this. Over his many years orbiting the Earth, the major has accumulated $15 million in flight pay, locked in a trust. Dr. Tunde needs your bank account to transfer the funds so they can pay the Russians a $3 million down payment for a rescue flight. And if you help, you get a 20% cut of the 15 million.
So 3 million bucks just for handing over your routing number. It's your classic advance fee fraud, just wrapped up in the craziest story ever.
Right, but here's what I don't get. If I'm a scammer and my goal is to steal your money, why would I use a story that is blatantly, scientifically impossible? Wouldn't you want it to sound realistic?
You'd think so, right. But that assumption actually completely misunderstands the economics of email fraud. The absurdity isn't a mistake. It's a highly engineered mathematical sorting tool.
A sorting tool? How so?
Well, look at the email. It uses real terms like Salyut and Soyuz to sound just real enough if you're skimming. But if you apply even 5 seconds of critical thought, the whole thing falls apart. No space agency could hide a lost astronaut for decades. Amateur astronomers track everything.
Yeah, and you can't survive on a 1980 space station for 30 years without massive life support upgrades.
Exactly. Plus, Nigeria didn't even have a space agency until 2001. So the scammer knows that 99.9% of people are going to spot those massive red flags instantly and delete the email.
Wait, don't they want people to reply?
They do, but they only want the right people to reply. This is what we call the absurdity filter. If you send out 10 million emails, the absolute worst thing for you as a scammer is a false positive.
Like someone who is skeptical but replies anyway just to see what's up?
Right. A moderately intelligent person who replies asks a dozen probing questions, demands proof, and then backs out when you ask for money. Because dealing with that person takes actual human time and effort.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The scammer has to sit there, type out replies, invent new lies.
Exactly. And if they do that 100 times a day and get zero payouts, they go broke. Their time is their most valuable resource. So by making the story completely impossible, they filter out the critical thinkers immediately.
Wow. So the absurdity is like an impenetrable wall.
Yep. The only people who hit reply to an email about a Nigerian astronaut stranded since 1990 are the most intensely gullible people on the internet. The scammer sacrifices volume to get highly qualified targets.
Okay, that makes so much sense. It's like a bizarre casting call. Imagine a theater director putting a massive typo on an audition flyer, or asking actors to show up at 3 a.m. wearing a clown nose. They don't actually want clowns. They just want to see who will blindly follow ridiculous directions without asking questions.
That is a perfect analogy. It guarantees compliance down the line. Because if you already believe a guy has been eating space rations since the Berlin Wall fell, you're not going to question a shady wire transfer to a random bank later on.
You've already bypassed your own logic, but you know, our research shows this tactic has evolved into something much darker. It didn't just stay as a wacky email blast.
No, it really morphed into something intimate and honestly, really tragic.
Yeah, let's talk about the Hokkaido case from late 2022. This involves an 80-year-old Japanese woman living alone, and she was contacted on Instagram, eventually listening to the messaging app Line.
Right. Moving the target to a more private, encrypted channel is classic grooming behavior.
So, the person on the other end claims to be a Russian astronaut currently on the International Space Station. But instead of immediately asking for money, they just text her every day for weeks, sharing mundane details, telling her he's falling in love with her, promising to move to Japan and marry her when his mission is over.
They built an entire emotional architecture around her. For someone living alone in her 80s, that daily check-in becomes her anchor. It completely overrides reality.
And when she's hooked, the trap snaps shut. He messages her in a panic, saying his spaceship is under attack and he is running out of life-saving oxygen.
Notice how the urgency is only introduced after the emotional dependency is secured.
Right, so he begs her to send money to buy oxygen and pay for a rocket ride back to Earth. And she ended up making 5 separate transfers from local convenience stores, sending about $6,700. She only called the cops when he kept demanding more money after she supposedly paid for his ticket home.
It is so devastating, and it really shows how the levers of manipulation change. With the 2004 email, the lever was greed mixed with gullibility. But here, the lever is profound loneliness and the desire for connection.
But I still struggle with the physics of the lie. Like, how does a person believe you can buy space oxygen via a wire transfer from a 7-Eleven?
Well, it's because of that grooming. By spending weeks building that romantic narrative, the scammer bypasses the brain's critical thinking centers. Mm. Our brains prioritize emotional survival over logic.
So by the time he asks for oxygen money, she's not evaluating the astrophysics of orbital life support.
Exactly. Her brain is just screaming, "The man I love is dying and I have to save him." The absurdity of the request doesn't even register.
Wow. Okay, so we're transitioning here from scammers who use absurdity as a passive filter for gullibility to scammers who actively engineer belief, exploiting ego, authority, and trust.
Right. We are leaving the digital inboxes and stepping into the luxury hotels of 1920s Paris. If we're talking about the taxonomy of deception, we have to talk about the apex predator.
Victor Lustig, the man who sold the Eiffel Tower, not once, but twice.
Lustig was a masterclass in reading human desire. He knew you don't sell an object. You sell the feeling the object gives the buyer.
So let's set the scene. It's 1925, Karas is booming, but dealing with massive debt. Lustig, this Austrian-Hungarian con artist, is sitting in a cafe. He reads a newspaper article about how expensive the Eiffel Tower is to maintain.
Which is crucial context. Today, the tower is untouchable. But in 1925, many Parisians hated it. It was built for the 1889 World's Fair and was only supposed to stand for 20 years. People legitimately debated tearing it down.
So Lustig finds that kernel of truth. He creates a fake persona as the Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Posts and Telegraphs. He invites a short list of wealthy scrap metal dealers to a highly confidential meeting at the Hotel Crillon, which was like the most luxurious hotel in Paris.
The venue choice is entirely deliberate. You invite someone to a dingy office, they're on guard. You invite them to the Hotel Crillon, their ego is stroked, they feel like they're in the inner circle.
And his props were flawless. His associate, dapper Dan Collins, literally seduced a government clerk to get a private tour of the ministry and stole actual official government stationery.
So the documents he handed out weren't even forgeries, they were real.
Insane. So Lustig tells these scrap metal titans that the government is secretly dismantling the tower and selling the 7,000 tons of iron for scrap. But it'd have to be a secret to avoid public riots. He takes him on tours and zeroes in on one guy, André Poisson.
Mr. Fish, you cannot write better irony.
Seriously.
No.
But why him? Poisson wasn't the richest.
No, but he was new money. He was insecure about his status among the old money Parisian elites. He was desperate to make a name for himself. Lustig smelled that insecurity.
He wanted the bragging rights of the ultimate secret government contract. But here's the crazy twist. Poisson's wife is suspicious. She doesn't like that the meetings are in hotel rooms. Poisson starts backing out. And Lustig, to save the deal, actually asks Poisson for a bribe.
Ah, yes, the corruption validation principle. It sounds totally counterintuitive.
Right. If I'm suspicious of a shady deal and the official asks for a bribe, I am running out of the room. Why did that make Poisson trust him more?
Because you have to look through Poisson's specific psychological lens. He was a cynical businessman in the 1920s. In his mind, high-level bureaucrats were inherently corrupt.
So when Lustig was playing the noble public servant, it felt fake to Poisson.
Exactly. The perfection of the disguise caused the suspicion. So Lustig pulls him aside, drops the Confident Act, and confesses his government salary is pitiful. He asks for 70,000 francs to grease the wheels.
And suddenly everything clicks for Poisson. He thinks, ah, here's the corrupt bureaucrat I expected. Now I know how the game is played.
By becoming complicit in the corruption, Poisson felt like an insider. The bribe proved the official was real.
That is incredibly dark, but brilliant. Poisson pays the bribe, plus 1.2 million francs for the tower. Lustig hops a train to Vienna with a suitcase of cash. And Poisson was so humiliated that he actually bribed a fake official, he never goes to the police. He just eats the loss.
His silence, driven entirely by ego, was Lustig's ultimate shield. It let him return to Paris a month later and try it again on new scrap dealers.
Wild. And Lustig's career in America is just as bonkers. We have to mention the Romanian box.
Oh, the Romanian box. Pure, unadulterated exploitation of greed.
Lustig carried this beautiful mahogany box with brass dials and slots. He'd find a wealthy target and confide that the machine could perfectly duplicate paper currency.
But the genius part was the operational friction. He claimed the chemical process took exactly 6 hours to duplicate one bill.
Right, if it spit out money instantly, it's a cheap magic trick. The weight made it feel like real science. He'd have the mark put a real $100 bill in. 6 hours later, he turns a crank, and the box spits out the original bill, plus a flawless duplicate he'd secretly hidden inside.
He'd even make them go to a bank to authenticate the bills. And since both were genuine currency, the bank teller would confirm they were real. The target's skepticism would just vanish.
So they beg him to sell the machine. He sells one to a Texas sheriff for thousands of dollars. The sheriff takes it home, puts his money in, waits 6 hours, turns the crank, and nothing. It's just a hollow box.
Which leads to one of the most brazen escapes ever.
The sheriff tracks Lustig to a hotel in Chicago, kicks down the door, and pulls a gun on him. Lustig doesn't even blink. He acts confused, tells the sheriff he must be turning the dials wrong, uses all this technical jargon to confuse him, and then says, look, I'll just refund your money, and hands the sheriff a massive stack of cash.
A stack of counterfeit cash. He literally conned the man who came to arrest him for the original pawn.
How does someone have that level of composure?
Well, Lustig documented his methods in his 10 Commandments for Con Men. It's basically a manual for hacking human psychology.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list here. Number one is, be a patient listener. It is this, not fast talking, that gets a con man his coup.
Which totally contradicts the sweaty, fast-talking, used car salesman stereotype. Lustig knew people love talking about themselves. If you listen, they will hand you the blueprints to their own insecurities.
And rule three, wait for the other person to reveal any political opinions, then agree with them. He basically acted as a human mirror.
Exactly. He made victims feel uniquely understood and important. When someone makes you feel that way, you are biologically disinclined to suspect them of malice.
It's so manipulative. And he wasn't the only one doing this. George C. Parker made a career selling the Brooklyn Bridge and the Met to tourists in New York. The police literally had to stop people from setting up toll booths on the bridge.
Hence the phrase, if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you.
Right. And in India, this guy, Netwarlo, sold the Taj Mahal twice. He even sold the Parliament House, supposedly with politicians included.
It's entertaining, but it forces us to look at the victimology here.
Yes, that's exactly what I want to theorize about. With the astronaut email, the victims were filtered for gullibility. But Poisson, the Texas sheriff, the bridge buyers, they aren't just gullible. They are aggressive participants. Is the real engine here the victim's own greed?
Without a doubt, the con artist doesn't create the greed, they just build a channel for it to flow into.
Yeah.
The sheriff wanted a machine that printed free money, completely bypassing the social contract of working for a living.
They believe they're inherently special.
Right.
Like they're getting an exclusive advantage that everyone else is too stupid to see.
Precisely. Now, if Lustig mastered selling something he didn't own, the next step in our taxonomy is selling something that doesn't even exist.
Yes. Transitioning from fabricating authority to fabricating physical geography. Gregor MacGregor and the country of Poyas.
The ultimate systemic illusion.
This story from 1821 completely short-circuited my brain. MacGregor, a Scottish soldier, returns to London and announces he is the prince or cazique of a country called Poyais in Central America.
A country that was entirely a figment of his imagination. The actual land was an uninhabitable malarial swamp.
But he builds what the sources call an infrastructure of the mind. He opens a Poyasian embassy in London, prints government bonds, gets composers to write a national anthem, and publishes a 350-page guidebook.
The guidebook is the key. What did he put in it?
A complete fantasy. He described the capital, St. Joseph, as this thriving European metropolis with opera houses. He said the riverbeds were lined with gold, and the soil was so fertile you could harvest corn 3 times a year without trying.
He understood that if you tell a lie, it must be so comprehensively documented that questioning it feels irrational to the target.
And the British public devoured it. He sold land rights, non-existent military commissions, netting over £50,000, which is tens of millions today. But this wasn't just financial fraud, it was a mass casualty event. 250 people actually packed up their lives and sailed across the Atlantic.
Imagine standing on the deck of that ship, expecting to see a bustling city skyline and arriving to find absolute nothingness.
Just dense, impenetrable jungle. No port, no city. Disease swept through the camp. Yellow fever, malaria, starvation. Fewer than 50 of those settlers survived to be rescued. MacGregor literally sold a fantasy that killed people.
It forces us to examine the concept of the big lie. If he tried to sell a single fake house, buyers would demand to see it. But because he fabricated an entire sovereign nation, people's critical faculties were overwhelmed. We assume massive structures require a foundation of truth.
The theatrics of scale. And we see the exact same architecture applied to financial markets in the 20th century. MacGregor fabricated geography. Charles Ponzi fabricated financial alchemy.
Right. Ponzi perfected the narrative required to sustain structural fraud. In 1920, he promised people in Boston a 50% return on investment in just 45 days.
Which should immediately set off alarm bells. How did he convince police officers and banks that his math worked?
He used a highly obscure, legitimate financial instrument to mask the theft. International reply coupons, or IRCs.
Which are just postal vouchers, right?
Yes. You'd buy one, mail it abroad, and your friend could exchange it for local postage. But after World War I, European currencies crashed against the US dollar. The postal treaties hadn't updated the exchange rates yet.
Ah, so he pointed out an arbitrage opportunity. Buy IRCs for pennies in Italy, ship them to the US, exchange them for stamps at the old higher rate, and sell the stamps for a massive profit.
Exactly. It sounded like a brilliant macroeconomic strategy. It gave the scheme a veneer of complex, untouchable financial logic.
But logistically impossible.
Completely impossible. To pay out millions, he would have needed cargo ships full of paper postal vouchers. He was just taking cash from new investors to pay the early ones.
Until a newspaper exposed the math and wiped out 6 banks. And the mechanism never dies, it just adapts. Like the LNG scam in Japan. Kazutsuginami scaled the Ponzi model to dystopian heights.
He defrauded 37,000 everyday people out of $1.4 billion.
By creating his own digital currency called N10, the divine yen, he threw these cult-like rallies, promising a 36% return. And his pitch was apocalyptic. He said global fiat economies were going to collapse, and his divine yen would be the only safe haven.
He weaponized systemic anxiety. And he sustained it by letting people use N10 to buy real goods like vegetables and futons at his special markets. It created a closed-loop reality where the fake money had actual purchasing power.
Which blinded them to the fact that the company was completely hollow. When he was arrested, his narcissism was chilling. He told reporters he was the poorest victim. He really believed he was providing a service.
The bigger the lie, the deeper the trust. It's a hardwired vulnerability.
Which brings us to a fascinating transition. from geographical and financial lies to physical biological lies, medical quackery, and the power of human belief.
Where fraud intersects with the desperate desire for healing.
So Dr. John R. Brinkley, in 1917, this guy bought his medical degree from a mail order catalog. A farmer complains of impotence, mentions his goats have lots of vitality, and Brinkley decides to surgically implant goat testicles into the human patient.
And the public response was overwhelmingly positive, which is terrifying.
He built a radio empire in Mexico just to advertise goat gland surgeries. Men paid thousands for this. And then Wilhelm Reich in the 30s, selling orgone energy accumulators, telephone booths made of steel wool that he claimed cured everything from depression to terminal cancer.
Classic snake oil salesman. They offer a miraculous cure that the medical establishment is supposedly hiding.
But there is one case from the 1790s that accidentally changed genuine medical science. Dr. Elisha Perkins.
Perkins secured the first medical device patent under the new U.S. Constitution for Perkins metallic tractors.
Two small metal rods, one brass, one steel. He claimed pain was caused by a noxious electrical fluid under the skin, and rubbing these rods drew the fluid out.
His marketing was revolutionary. He priced them at 5 guineas, about $500 today. He pitched it as disruptive technology. Why pay a doctor forever when you can buy this once and cure your family?
Sounds exactly like a Silicon Valley pitch today. And he got George Washington to supposedly buy a set. Wealthy people were selling their carriages to afford these rods. But then a British physician named John Haygarth stepped in.
Right. In 1799, Haygarth wanted to rigorously test if the metal actually had healing properties. He gathered patients with severe chronic pain, like rheumatism. On day one, he used the real expensive metal tractors.
And the patients felt better, right?
Yes, a significant majority reported a profound reduction in pain. Some who could barely walk had improved mobility.
Which must have annoyed Haygarth.
But he was prepared. On day two, he brought them back and repeated the exact procedure. But this time, without telling them, he used ordinary wooden sticks that he'd painted to look identical to the metal rods.
Counterfeit tractors?
Entirely inert wooden sticks. And the outcome was revolutionary. The patients reported the exact same profound reduction in pain.
Wait, so the healing wasn't the tool. It was just the brain flooding the nervous system with endogenous painkillers because it expected to be healed.
Precisely. Haygarth meticulously documented that the physiological response was generated entirely by the patient's deeply held belief. This is widely considered the first rigorous scientific documentation of the placebo effect.
That is mind-blowing. A brazen medical fraud inadvertently handed science the exact tool we use today for double-blind pharmaceutical studies. Perkins was a quack, but he forced us to quantify the physical power of human expectation.
He proved the human mind can override physical pain if the narrative is strong enough. And if we look at how that mechanism of blind faith is weaponized today, we see it aggressively in modern crowdfunding. Platforms like Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
Yes, the modern medicine show. These platforms democratize funding but remove regulatory oversight, like the Triton artificial gills.
A textbook example of technological illusion.
They promised a tiny mouthpiece that extracts breathable oxygen directly from seawater, so you can swim underwater for 45 minutes without tanks. They raised over $1 million fast.
But the scientific community pointed out it violates the fundamental laws of fluid dynamics. For a device that microscopic to filter enough dissolved oxygen, you'd basically need a jet engine attached to your face pumping water.
The internet physicists dismantled it. So how did the creators respond? They posted an update saying, "Our secret breakthrough isn't filtering water. The device uses replaceable cartridges filled with liquid oxygen."
Which is an even more scientifically absurd fabrication. Liquid oxygen is cryogenic. It has to be stored below negative 297 degrees Fahrenheit.
So if you put a vial of that into a room temperature plastic mouthpiece,
it would rapidly boil, expand enormously, and likely explode in your mouth.
Insane. And yet they launched a second campaign and raised nearly $500,000 before the platform finally shut them down. And then there's the Regium Wonderboard for chess.
Right, capitalizing on the desire for physical interaction in digital spaces.
An auto-moving wooden chess board. They raised huge money, got chess influencers on board. But tech experts noticed the prototype videos were actually stolen, edited footage of another product, and the team behind it. They were AI-generated faces.
Pure malicious fabrication. But in crowdfunding, we have to distinguish between malicious scammers and incompetent visionaries. The outcome for the consumer is the same. They lose their money, but the intent is vastly different.
Our sources contrast the Xano drone with the Fort campaign. Xano promised palm-sized swarming drones, used deceptive editing and hidden wires to fake prototypes. They knowingly oversold a reality they couldn't deliver.
Contrast that with Fort. The creator wanted to make magnetic foam building blocks for kids, a viable product. But to drive hype, he offered aggressive 50% discounts.
He priced it below the cost of manufacturing.
Exactly. Ruined his margins before the factory opened. Then the pandemic hit, supply chains broke, shipping costs skyrocketed, and he hadn't charged for shipping up front. He simply didn't have the capital to fulfill the 10,000 orders. It wasn't malice. It was a devastating failure of business acumen.
But whether it's liquid oxygen lies or shipping miscalculations, why do tech-literate people hand over thousands of dollars for stuff that violates basic physics?
It's a behavioral economics phenomenon called first-mover bias. In the tech community, there is immense social prestige in being an early adopter. People desperately want to fund the next Apple in the garage phase.
So that desire completely overrides their critical thinking.
Right. They want the artificial gills to be real so badly, they willingly ignore the cryogenic realities of liquid oxygen. The narrative defeats the science.
Wow. And while tech scams rely on our secular faith in Silicon Valley, other scams exploit much older, deeper roots. We're talking cultural, religious, and spiritual beliefs.
This is where deception takes on a much darker, visceral tone. The intersection of fraud and the supernatural.
Let's start in rural India with the rice pulling epidemic. Fraudsters approach wealthy businessmen offering to fell antique copper pots or old coins. They claim these objects are made of a rare copper iridium alloy that possesses magical atomic power. And the proof is that the object literally pulls grains of rice toward it.
To a Western listener, it sounds comical, but we're talking about transactions involving millions of rupees. They weave a highly authoritative mythology around it.
Yeah, they forge documents from the Reserve Bank of India, claim NASA or India's defense agency desperately needs these pots for nuclear technology. They tell the victim, buy this for a few million today, the government will buy it for billions tomorrow.
But how do they physically demonstrate a copper pot pulling rice in the room?
Pure high school chemistry and stagecraft. They secretly mix microscopic iron dust into the rice and hide powerful neodymium magnets in the copper pot. So the magnetized rice literally jumps to the metal. It looks like atomic magic. And to sell the danger, they do the pitch-wearing bulky anti-radiation suits and sweep the room with fake Geiger counters.
It is a masterclass in theatrical validation. They weaponize the mystique of space agencies to validate a traditional superstition about lucky artifacts.
Brilliant stagecraft. But the next evolution completely abandons stagecraft and descends into pure horror. Let's talk about the internet fraud evolution in Nigeria. We know the Yahoo boys, the guys in internet cafes running 419 advance fee frauds or romance scams. But that culture has mutated into a faction known as Yahoo Plus.
Which is the formal integration of cybercrime with cyber spiritualism.
Yes. These scammers are running complex phishing campaigns, but they don't believe the technology alone guarantees a payout. They actively employ voodoo priests and witch doctors to create charms and potions.
They genuinely believe performing occult rituals over their laptops projects a hypnotic force through the internet.
Yeah, they think the magic travels to the screen to paralyze the victim's critical thinking. They use bizarre items, like used sanitary pads, believing it will cloak their IP addresses from law enforcement.
The digital world becomes highly susceptible to the spiritual world. But there's an even more extreme tier, Yahoo Plus Plus.
This is where it crosses from financial fraud into outright atrocity. Yahoo Plus Plus involves actual human sacrifice and organ harvesting to fuel cyber rituals. Scammers consult a witch doctor before launching a major attack on a corporate network.
And our sources explicitly detail a case where a cyber criminal was instructed by a witch doctor that he required two left eyes and a young woman's left breast to complete a ritual to hack a secure computer network.
It's sickening. And the caveat is the victim usually can't be older than 25. So these syndicates actively hunt for vulnerable targets. Homeless young women, girls desperate for jobs. They lure them to abandoned buildings, kidnap them, murder them, and harvest the specific organs for these cyber rituals. Scammers have even sacrificed their own girlfriends to guarantee a massive payout.
It is a horrifying intersection of modern digital crime and ancient ritual murder.
I am so deeply disturbed, but analytically fascinated by the psychology here. Imagine a young man who is technically proficient enough to spoof IP addresses and execute a multi-tiered corporate hack in London. He understands the architecture of the modern digital world. Yet, simultaneously, he relies on a witch doctor's potion to make the code execute properly. How do those two worldviews coexist?
It creates cognitive dissonance for us. But it has internal logic in their socioeconomic environment. These are desperate young men in a society with extreme poverty, yet they see immense unexplained wealth all around them. To them, the internet is a highly complex, invisible domain where outcomes appear magical.
Right, you type some text in Legos, and 3 days later, thousands of dollars materialize from Ohio.
Exactly. Because the underlying technology functions like magic to them, it's a very short psychological leap to believe that dark magic can influence the digital outcome. They view the internet as a spiritual medium, a digital ether manipulatable by occult forces.
So the laptop isn't a tool, it's an altar. And the human sacrifice is the offering to make the altar work.
Precisely. Now, while Yahoo++ is the violently artisanal edge of deception, the global taxonomy is undergoing a massive structural shift right now. What happens when the art of the canary, from Lustig's private meetings to these terrifying rituals, is entirely replaced by cold corporate global industrialization?
This brings us to the final and maybe most consequential section of our deep dive, the rise of the Southeast Asian scam farms.
This is the most significant systemic shift in the history of global fraud. The era of the lone wacky scammer in a basement is over. We are dealing with multinational corporations of fraud.
The scale is almost incomprehensible. The sources detail an estimated $64 billion annual criminal economy centered in the Mekong region, Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos. We're talking about massive fortified compounds, some covering over 500 acres, places like KK Park in Myanmar.
From the outside, they look like self-contained, hyper-modern tech campuses, high-rise dormitories, supermarkets, karaoke bars.
But the perimeter is surrounded by high walls, barbed wire, and armed guards. They are highly profitable slave camps. And this introduces the dual victim tragedy of the modern scam industry.
Right. You have the traditional victims losing their life savings in America or Europe, but the people actually sitting at the keyboards typing the messages are victims themselves.
The human trafficking data is staggering. Over 300,000 people from more than 60 different countries have been trafficked into these centers. They apply for legitimate sounding tech support or translation jobs on LinkedIn. They fly to Thailand expecting a corporate job, and the second they leave the airport, they're driven across the border, passports confiscated. Trapped.
Forced to work grueling 12 to 19 hour shifts, running industrial scale pig butchering scams and fake crypto exchanges.
Let's break down the pig butchering scam, because it shows how industrialized the psychology has become. It starts with an accidental text message. "Hi John, are we still meeting for golf?" You reply, "Sorry, wrong number." Instead of leaving, the scammer says, "Oh, you seem nice, let's be friends."
Over weeks, they build a relationship. They're fattening up the pig.
Right, then they casually mention how much money they're making on a crypto platform and invite you to try it. They send you to a website that looks incredibly professional, live charts, customer service. You put in $100, it shows a 20% profit, you withdraw it successfully.
The trust is cemented.
So you put in your life savings, and the moment you try to withdraw the big money, the platform freezes, demands huge tax payments to unlock the funds, and eventually vanishes. The entire dashboard was a simulation controlled by the compound.
And the trafficked workers executing these long cons are under immense pressure. They have massive daily quotas, sometimes forced to extract up to $9,500 a day. If they fail or try to escape, the punishment is horrific.
The UN reports detail severe beatings, electric cattle prods, and being placed in water prisons, small cages submerged in polluted water where you can't sit or sleep without drowning. It is systematized torture just to maximize quarterly profit margins.
And the macroeconomic impact is destabilizing. Look at the data from 2024. Citizens of Thailand alone lost an estimated $17.2 billion to these networks.
That's 3.4% of Thailand's entire GDP, just siphoned out of the legitimate economy. And Cambodia generates an estimated $12.5 billion from these centers, which is roughly half of Cambodia's formal GDP.
Which raises the question, if these are massive physical cities generating billions, why doesn't the military shut them down?
Right. Why are they operating in broad daylight?
Because of systemic institutional complicity. They are allegedly protected by elite business syndicates and senior government officials. Our sources highlight a Chinese-Cambodian tycoon named Chen Zi, sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury for operating these transnational cyber empires, yet simultaneously serving as an official advisor to the Cambodian Prime Minister.
When a criminal enterprise generates half your GDP, the government has zero financial incentive to stop it. The state is a partner in the fraud. What terrifies me the most is that technology is a force multiplier for this cruelty. These farms are rapidly integrating generative AI.
Historically, the absurdity filter, or the language barrier, protected us. If a scammer in Myanmar wanted to target an American or a Japanese woman, they needed to speak convincing English or Japanese.
AI completely eradicates that friction. A trafficked worker from Ethiopia who speaks neither English nor Japanese can sit at a terminal, use an AI tool, and flawlessly romance a victim in Hokkaido in perfect, culturally nuanced Japanese.
It can generate voice notes indistinguishable from a real human. You don't need 1,000 linguists anymore, you just need software and a room full of terrified people clicking buttons. They are running global A/B testing on human vulnerability.
So pulling back to look at this whole picture, we're facing a $64 billion industrialized machine armed with AI, utilizing torture, protected by sovereign governments. If I'm an individual consumer, how do I possibly protect myself against that?
We have to assume a posture of zero trust in the digital realm. The old defenses, bad grammar, wacky narratives won't tip us off anymore. Verification of identity has to happen off-platform. If someone asks for money on WhatsApp, you have to verify via a phone call to a known number.
It requires us to constantly monitor our own emotional vulnerabilities.
Exactly. Recognizing when our desire to believe is overriding our capacity to think.
Okay, so let's synthesize this massive journey. We started with the absurdity filter of the Nigerian astronaut email filtering for gullibility by defying basic science. We walked with Victor Lustig selling the Eiffel Tower by exploiting a man's cynical expectation of corruption.
We saw Elisha Perkins's wooden rods accidentally birth the placebo effect, proving belief dictates physical reality. We explored the Kickstarter era, weaponizing the tech world's first mover bias.
And we tracked the dark evolution from the cyber-spiritualism of Yahoo++ in Nigeria right up to the tragic multi-billion dollar scam farms in Southeast Asia. So looking at this whole taxonomy, what is the ultimate takeaway?
The core takeaway is that the architecture of the con is rarely about the physical object being pitched. It's never truly about scrap metal or liquid oxygen or a stranded astronaut. Deception is entirely about the story the victim desperately wants to believe to fill a specific psychological, social, or physiological void.
Whether that void is driven by greed, the hope for healing, or the agonizing ache of loneliness.
Exactly. The master fraudster doesn't invent the vulnerability. They merely identify the void and engineer a flawless, custom-built mirage to fill it.
It is a dark mirror reflecting our deepest unacknowledged desires back at us. Which brings us to the end of our deep dive today. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a lingering thought. For centuries, we've relied on our internal absurdity filters to protect us. We laughed at bad grammar, impossible physics, or the wacky premise of a stranded astronaut to separate reality from fraud.
But as generative AI empowers these $64 billion scam farms to manufacture perfectly tailored, flawless realities.
What happens to our society when the scams finally stop looking wacky? What happens when the distress signal calling out to you doesn't sound like a Nigerian astronaut, but sounds exactly, flawlessly like the voice of someone you love? It is a reality we all need to be psychologically prepared to face.
Yeah, that is the ultimate question of the next decade.
Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Scams. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.